The Nature of Dragons by Arthur Rybak. Chapter 1. 20 years later. Like a gargantuan beast, a vast iron wall curls about the city of Chosa. At odds with the strict architecture of the buildings, the ugly thing rises up, towering over even the highest roofs, with only the Black Tower itself visible beyond its enormity. Outside the rusting wall, a steady stream of men and women in soft summer linens abandon the fields for the night and lumber towards town, down the high road that splits the farmland in two. The sun, a bloody streak across the purple sky, rests just above the horizon, warming the farmers' backs. Heads turn compulsively, glancing back at it, and they quicken their pace, even though there's still a good hour till sunset. Stepping over the threshold of the city, they cross themselves, touching foreheads, hearts, and lips. Some release a nervous sigh. The farmers move deeper into town, leading their wagons loaded with produce to the storage units, as shepherds drive oxen or cows or flocks of sheep back to the stables. There's a uniformity to their movements, a well-practiced 1-2-3 where everyone keeps their cue. "Never ending," mutters a farmer, stepping aside to let a young woman and her mare ahead of himself. "Drudgery," she replies with a shy smile. The man watches her go, shifts his basket from one arm to the other. Abandoning his post, a gateman in a rooster-red uniform comes to stand beside the farmer, watching the procession. "Give us a honey apple, then," he says, tugging at his sleeves. They're a little worn and faded around the edges, but perfectly clean. "Can't them going directly to the tower?" "Go on," says the gateman, knocking his shoulder against the farmer's. "Masha's craving all sorts of madness these days." "She's pregnant? Again? How many have you gotten already? 4? 5, the gateman replies with a grin. "Make her protect you. Any of them spinning?" "Not the one." Shaking his head, the farmer glances at the Black Tower. "He's draining us, ain't he?" The gateman doesn't reply, sidesteps an old man pushing a wheelbarrow. He shrugs a shoulder. "Garish, my neighbor, has 6 boys, and all 6 of them are so weak they can't even light a candle. May as well have been born hollow." He rubs the back of his neck. "Who knows, though? Maybe a honey apple for my Masha will sort our next little one right out." With an indulgent shake of his head, the farmer laughs. He picks out one of the larger honey apples from his basket and passes it to the gatekeeper. "You make a kid that can spin, and he better be helping me with the harvest till the maker takes me. Free of charge, mind you." "On my name and honor," says the guard, knocking his fist over his heart. "May the night hold no danger for you," says the farmer. He taps his temple with a finger, heaves his basket higher in his arms, and starts down the street. The gateman polishes the honey apple against his chest, inspects it, and noticing he's being watched, hurries back to his post. Solana purses her lips, glances down at her younger brother. "What just happened there? Do you think it was good or bad?"
"Bad," says Russell, clutching the child-sized saber at his hip.
He's completely grown out of the thing, she realizes. She'll have to order the smith to make him a new one before she leaves, as a parting gift, perhaps. Russell looks up at her for confirmation, and Solana wonders how many of these strolls they have left together. Once she's wed, Chosa will be deemed too dangerous for her, even for brief visits. She tips her head at him, indicating he should go on. "The farmer stole from the tower," he says, "and should be punished for it." "Do you know how he'll be paid?" she asks. Russell frowns. "How he'll be paid for the stolen honey apple?"
"No," says Solana. "For the delivered honey apples."
"Oh, by the weight of the basket." "And so, if he's to be paid by the weight of the basket, how is it stealing?"
"It's not?" he asks, looking up at her, hopeful. Solana nods.
"It's not. It is important to see a thing for what it is. He did not give the guard 12. He did not spill the apples on the street. That honey apple wasn't taken from the basket in order to deny our kitchen's apples. Nor was it given away to feed our enemies. The farmer spent his day laboring in the fields and gifted a single fruit of his labor, not just to his friend, but to his pregnant wife. Perhaps that single apple will determine the health of her child, and with the population ever declining, the apple is more valuable to us in her belly,"
says Russell, face lighting up with realization. Then in ours.
Yes, she touches his thick, dark hair. Come, it's almost dinner time.
They follow the crowd away from the gate. The people recognize them and keep half a step back, though whether out of respect or fear or some sort of pity, it is impossible to say.
Hard to blame the people. Who else are they to hold accountable for their struggles, if not the Mordeths?
Stopping right in the middle of Main Street, they look up at the Black Tower, rising tall and angry up ahead, its dark glossy surface gleaming garnet in the setting sun.
You look like you're glowing in this light, says Russell, and Solana gives him a gentle smile.
He's her single comfort in an endless procession of difficult days. Farmers part around them as though the Mordeths are an island trapped in the heart of their river, slicing through the current formed by the workers with the power of their permanence.
A man, too tall and too skinny to be completely healthy, limps over to stop in front of them. From his brown woven basket, he scoops a single plum, so ripe, it's almost black.
A beautiful plum for the beautiful Lady Mordeth, he says. She takes the fruit from his skeletal hand, rubbing a thumb over its velvet-soft skin. Grinning, he reaches into the basket once more and crouches in front of Russell. And one for the young Lord Mordeth, too.
One's more than enough for the two of us, good man, she says, splitting the thing in two in demonstration.
But she doesn't pass Russell his half, nor does she eat hers. As likely poisoned as not, what with so many of Chosa's citizens still hoping to put the Nurak invaders back into the tower, but it won't do, to be seen refusing gifts from the people. The man nods, rising awkwardly to his feet, wincing as he straightens. Solana touches the farmer's sharp shoulder.
You should stop by the hospital. Tell Lillian I sent you. She'll look you over.
No healings can heal fear, m'lady, he says, bowing himself in half before disappearing into the crowd.
Can I have it? Asks Russell, but Solana gives a barely perceptible shake of her head and palms the plum halves.
She'll dispose of them later, where there's no chance of them being picked up by Russell or anyone else. A sheep brushes against her skirts, and she reaches out a hand, running her palm over its thick coat, and all at once they're surrounded by them, baying and fearless and a little smelly. Russell laughs as Solana grins at the sheepherder who shrugs a shoulder at them with an apologetic smile. The sheep leave, and so does the shepherd, and in a breath it seems the entire street clears. Solana glances back at the setting sun. Minutes to curfew. They need to get back to the tower immediately.
Dear child, help an old Baba with her burden, yes?
Solana starts, turns around to find a wrinkled old woman, so small she barely reaches Russell's shoulder, staring up at them. Her thin gray hair rises in a tangled halo about her head, perfectly matching the gray of her dress and two linen sacks resting at her feet. Placing a hand on Russell's shoulder, Solana hesitates a beat. She can refuse the woman, get both herself and Russell back into the tower before the bells sound, but it wouldn't do, leaving the grandmother to fend for herself. Solana looks up and down the street. The public's already safely tucked inside. There's no one left to replace herself with. She can take Russell with them, she supposes. But the very idea of their father finding out that she kept him out past curfew makes her palms sweat. She'll have to send Russell home on his own. It's a risk, of course. He might run into the faithless. But the tower gates aren't far, and he's 12, and armed, if not very dangerous.
Run home, she says, touching his shoulder. Don't stop until you're inside the tower.
I don't... He starts, but Solana shakes her head. Go on, she orders. He balls his fists, opens his mouth to protest, closes it again, then tugs her down for a kiss on the cheek, and with a little wave, sprints off up Main Street.
Don't worry your pretty bones, murmurs the old woman. His path winds safe enough tonight.
Solana watches him, then sighs, lifting a sack and heaving it over her shoulder. The old woman reaches for the other, but Solana brushes her hand away. They're heavy, the bags, and Solana, unused to burdens of any kind, finds herself staggering under their combined weight. How in the Maker's name had so tiny a woman gotten them this far?
Lead on, Solana says, curt with the approaching sunset, though she doesn't mean to be.
and the woman gives her a long, appraising look, before turning on her heel and shuffling off down an alley. The woman walks fast and slow in turn, leading Solana down such a labyrinth of empty streets that she's completely turned about, even though she knows Chosa well enough to navigate it blind. Solana has to stop her twice and set the sacks on the ground to rest her arms.
The little Mordith needs to get better at load-bearing, grins the crone, if she doesn't want her shoulders to crack.
Yes? Resisting the urge to glare at her is no easy task. She would be dressing for dinner right now if it weren't for the woman.
If we hurry, says Solana, I'll be able to help you with your sacks before sunset, and you won't be stuck with my company overnight.
Your company isn't quite so awful, little Mordith. Not quite so awful, though one day it will be.
Eventually, the two of them reach a small door in a twisted little alleyway. Solana knows she's walked down the alley before, but perhaps it's the weight of the bags, or the ever-dimming light. But she can't quite seem to figure out where they are. The Baba lays her palm upon the door and pushes it open without unlocking it first, then ushers Solana inside. Thick candles bathe the room in a foggy yellow glow, illuminating braids of drying herbs hanging off the low ceiling. Delicate painted icons and small charm pouches decorate every available surface. Old magic, this. Nothing at all to do with the Scylla or the Maker. Magic from a time well gone, when people still prayed to clouds for rain and to the sun for good harvest. It's a surprising find, right in the middle of Chosa. Grace, with the ability to touch the Scylla fading in the city's population and the children being born hollow as often as not, are people turning back to old superstitions? A light flickers and Solana gasps. Three human skulls mounted on iron spikes blink merrily at her with glowing green eyes. But no, they're just ugly candle holders with green glass in the sockets, probably crafted to scare away children.
Stack sacks softly on the step, says the old woman, before opening a drawer and taking a gold coin from it. Gifts for troubles.
She offers it to Solana in an open palm. Then she grins, exposing two rows of gleaming metallic teeth, each tooth filed to a vicious point. Solana nearly chokes in fright.
Keep it, she says, slowly laying down the sacks and taking a very careful step back. I've no need for coin.
Oh, in my bones I taste the smell of a righteous soul, cackles the old woman, and Solana rubs her arms, at once cold and flushed and out of breath.
Perhaps a charm, then?
No. Eternal fire? The skull's eyes will burn until the Maker snatches time right from our grasp. Solana shakes her head, fingers grasping behind her, until she feels the brass doorknob beneath them. The Baba's metallic teeth flash again, and Solana swallows, abruptly realizing that she's terribly afraid of this old woman. Thank the Maker she sent Russell home.
A wish, then? Whispers the woman. No. An answer. Ask, child. Ask any question, and as payment for your time and your risk.
She glances out of the window. It's almost dark.
The truth will be gifted, yes? Debts cannot remain unpaid.
Solana starts to shake her head. But the woman's words are true, and Solana doesn't want this woman seeking her out in some attempt to repay the debt she thinks she owes her. Others can perhaps turn from tradition, but as a Mordith, she doesn't have that right. Even as a woman, she is responsible for all the country's subjects, at least until she is wed, and her responsibilities shift to her husband's population. So Solana wills her pattering heart to slow and releases the doorknob with a frown. She has to ask a question. My wedding day, her voice comes out in a croak. She clears her throat. Tries again. Kind grandmother, my wedding day fast approaches, and I will be sent north to marry Marcus and become Queen of Uid. I so look forward. She stumbles on the lie, banishes the image of herself living in that cold, mountainous country, then clears her throat and forces herself to continue, to sharing his life and his lands and his bed. The Baba laughs, her teeth flashing silver daggers in the candlelight.
Sit, sit, little Mordith. She gestures to a small, lace-covered table by the fireplace, and Solana notices clusters of cloudy gemstones decorating the worn-out material of the Baba's ill-fitting gray dress. The cloth had been rich once, richer than anything she's seen outside of the throne room.
Odd. Solana inclines her head.
It is a good union, she says, taking a seat at the table.
and with Uid being the only country in the land still willing to trade with Chosa. Well, as my father says, retaining the alliance with Uid is vital for our survival. Well, Chosa's survival, I suppose, as I won't be a part of our country much longer, and Marcus loves me dearly, so I'll be safe and happy in his land. Uncharacteristically nervous, Solana wrings her hands, rubs at her face with her palms. The old woman pats Solana on the head like she would a child, muttering, "So ask your question. Ask. Yes." And when Solana says nothing, the old woman tuts and walks off, through a curtain, its beads clicking an uneven staccato about her shrunken frame. Solana sighs, sits back in the chair, picks up one of the thumb-sized linen charm bags. She runs a finger over the red cross stitches. It feels heavy for its size, and some silly, childish part of her mind imagines that the thing is warm. She puts it down. The crone returns, carrying a red teapot with two mugs dangling off a finger, and Solana, manners beaten in so deep they're almost instinct, rises to help her. The woman shakes her head. "Sit, sit. An old baba can manage just fine without your little bones." Solana hesitates, but at a sharp gesture from the woman returns to her seat. "Our first child will be a boy, I'm certain. I can feel it. But how to make sure?" "If you are certain," says the baba, setting the cups on the table, "why make sure?" Solana licks her lips, glances away from the cups as the woman pours out the tea. "You know well of what happens to queens that fail to produce male heirs." The baba pushes a cup in Solana's direction. She must pick up on the way Solana stiffens because she says, "No poison here, dear one." Lifting the offered cup, Solana looks down into its foggy contents. "I would never assume you..." "Of course not." The baba smiles a vicious smile and spreads her skirts, taking the stool across from Solana. "Drink up." Solana blows the steam rising in circles from the mug and sips. The tea is thick and unsweetened, but pleasant nonetheless, with a deep earthy taste, and before she's even noticed, it's all gone. The baba takes the cup from her and places it upside down upon the table. The remaining brown liquid seeps into the yellowed lace of the tablecloth. She holds the cup down a moment, as though afraid that it will run away, then lifts it back up to peer inside. "You don't need to accept your fate," she says eventually. "You may wed, produce a litter of brats, enough boys to preserve your position and your head, though that sugar-sweet northern lord will let you keep that, even if you prove barren. So you may wed and breed and die, and it will be enough. No prophecy is so strong that you must live by it." "You got that from the tea?" "No, the tea told me that you're stubborn, foolish, and completely incapable of controlling yourself." Solana barks out an astonished laugh, and all at once the mood is lighter, in spite of the night settling outside the window. "All valuable characteristics when ruling a country," Solana says, giving the old woman an indulgent smile. "Even one that's been reduced to a city." "Little one, ruling this land will never fall to you, and most certainly not the other. And that's no secret. Ruling Chosa will fall to her elder brother, and ruling Uid to her husband eventually." "Oh dear, it makes you feel weak, yes? Weak and pathetic. Your father, your brother, why, even your betrothed preform miracles, and all the while you rot right along with the rest of this country. Unable to spin enough to light a candle? Selfish child?" "I'm not selfish. I'm giving up my freedom for this land." "Liar! You don't know what giving up your freedom for this land means. Your mother, she gave up her freedom. Her freedom and her head for this land. Your wedding? It's no collar. It's your only way out of your destiny." Solana frowns, tries to untangle what the old woman is saying, but she keeps speaking, unaware of or uninterested in her guest's confusion. "And it's best for everyone you marry. Best for everyone you take this offered way out. You should trust your father's nightmares. He's right to fear you. Right to keep you caged inside your body. Saving this infested chunk of land won't bring anyone peace." Solana shakes her head, baffled. What on earth is the baba on about? "Do you offer puzzles or answers?" Solana snaps, patience suddenly gone. Here's the answer. If you raise one monster to kill the other, you will become the monster yourself. That is your fate. I did not ask for my fate. I asked for my... Outside, the doorbells sound. Thousands of them, round and deep. The room quakes with the sound. A reminder and a warning. In a quarter of an hour, outside all doors, death will await the population. It's too late. Too late to go home now. She's stuck here, in this room, with this woman for the night. Either that, or break her father's law. The risk, of course. Worse than any beating or poisoned cake. Solana looks at the meat of her palm, wonders what the skeleton beneath it looks like, wonders if she'll be recognizable when all that's left of her are bones. "You've kept me too long," she says, turning away. "Fret not, little Mordeth. You're close enough to the tower to get there in time." "How do you know?" Solana asks. "Either everything I say is the truth," the woman replies, "or everything I say is a lie. You'll need to test it on your delicious flesh." She laughs, as though it's some great joke. "Say what you mean," snaps Solana, "or keep your words for someone else." Oh, in my bones. All at once exhausted, Solana gathers her skirts and rises from the chair. "Rest well, grandmother. May the night hold no danger for you," she says, curtsying to the woman. The Baba's fingers curl about Solana's wrist. "I know what you want." "Yes?" Solana asks. "And what's that?" "You want to be freed from the duty you have to the people of Chosa. But in order to earn your freedom, you must first earn theirs. It's the only way." "And how do I do that?" says Solana, turning back to face her. "Lead them out of Chosa into the rest of the world? Even if we could get through the leagues of demon-infested farmland, who would have us? What would we do? Beg in city streets? No, their lives are hard, their nights traitorous. But there is dignity in our suffering. What is there for us beyond our border? Nothing. What awaits us there? Again, nothing." "I did not say you should leave the land," says the crone. "I'm saying you should cleanse it. You destroy the demons, and all of Chosa will be free. Even the lands you've lost to them already. Everything can be cleansed." Solana laughs and laughs and laughs. Laughs so hard she's almost crying, has to sit back down to catch her breath. "You think we haven't tried? You think we've what? Been up there in our tower, twiddling our thumbs? My father's commissioned stampedes of the greatest thinkers in the lands in an attempt to do just that. Grace, we don't even know what the demons are. They rise like mist every night, and anything alive, man or beast, caught out in that mist is devoured within seconds. Nothing left of them, just bones. That's it. That's all we know. We don't know what it is. We don't know how to stop it. The Nurak invaders were thrown out of our borders, and this was the gift they left behind. New construction doesn't work. Anything built on demon-infested land is still subject to the same rules. Wards don't work. Swords don't work. And yet, you want me, unable to spin, unable to even feel the Sila, to find solutions that are nowhere to be found." Solana rises once more and storms towards the door, but the old woman is there, blocking her exit. "The only value I bring is my womb," Solana says, moving closer to the woman, hoping to crowd her out of the way. "For it, I may be traded to ensure the country's survival. There it is, the most I can do. This is my awesome, earth-shattering power. Is this what you expect to rid Chosa of the demons that have been plaguing our knights for 20 years? The Baba rolls her eyes, pushes Solana back. She's surprisingly strong for one so old. "You see?" she says. "You've no self-control whatsoever. Did I imply you have the power to save your country? No, little Mordeth. You're as powerless as a babe, but the White Lady..." "Hush your foolish mouth," snaps Solana. "Such blasphemy is punishable by death." "The White Lady," the woman says again, as though Solana hadn't spoken, "can free your people in one fell swoop. Free you. No more Marcus." "I want to marry Marcus. Now please step aside." "Lies," says the woman, ignoring Solana's request. "You want to escape your burden and your duty. You want to close your eyes and no longer see your people suffering. You want to wake in the morning and not find bones of the dead upon the streets, and you think he's the quickest way.
No,
But see this, says the old woman. If you find the white lady, if you remove the demons, then you'll owe no more duty to your father, no more duty to Chosa, and you'll earn both freedom and power, all without pledging yourself to a man you can hardly tolerate. A nice deal, yes? Delightful, says Solana, rolling her eyes. Perhaps I'll speak to the wind while I'm at it. Ask it for good harvest, or whisper to the oceans, order their retreat, so that we may gather the riches at their depth. Why not just go to the Maker directly? Command him to remake the world in my image. Just imagine. Chosa's houses swaddled in taffeta and pearls. Off north with you, then, the woman replies. Trot off to marry your Marcus. No one can force you to do your duty to the people. Step aside, and I'll be off. The old woman doesn't move.
I am doing my duty to the people, Solana says with a sigh. I'm marrying Marcus for my people. I may be glad for it. I may be so excited to leave here I can barely breathe. I'm well aware that getting out from Father's line of sight is no small gift. But after it all, after all that, I am doing it for my people. With this union, their survival will be secured.
Lies, cackles the woman. Lies! You're marrying Marcus to scuttle off from your responsibilities, to say, I have done it all. I have done all that's in my power. If you want to live and die with honor, little Mordeth, you must wake the White Lady and force her to cleanse the land.
That's impossible. The White Lady is a myth, a monster the church invented to keep the lands in check, to scare us silly with false claims of devastation and blood. And even if we, for the sake of argument, assume she's more woman than myth, you realize that seeking her help is like asking the executioner to remove a cuticle with his axe.
No. No, child. The woman comes in close, pulls Solana down by the shoulder, whispers in her ear. I heard it, yes? I heard it singing in the wind. Chosa's hope is with the Lady Light, though perhaps you don't want the hope she brings. Perhaps you don't want to pay the price for Chosa's freedom. Perhaps you don't want to pay the price for yours.
The demons are not my problem.
But they are, girl. You are a Mordeth, and the Mordeths rule this land. Every newborn is yours to protect. Every man or woman dead is your responsibility. Your mother, foreign though she was, knew it well.
Why don't you?
I've enough of your nonsense, Solana snaps, bodily pushing the woman away from the door. I need to go. She pushes it open. Then she hesitates, all at once, tethering on the edge of darkness. If she's too far from the tower entrance, she's dead. Deciding it's worth the risk, Solana crosses the threshold and, hitching her skirts high, runs all the way back to the Black Tower. She crosses the threshold, and a moment later, a million chiming bells start ringing. It's time. She turns around, looks outside. Thick fog rises from the ground. It doesn't get high. It rises only to the knee, lower on a tall man. It seems benign, a soft, gentle moving surface. If one didn't know its properties, one would call the fog beautiful. This is what the people of her country call the demons. It covers everything, every inch of land, sparing only houses. The fog is white and swirling, water-like. It makes you want to touch it, Solana thinks, as she pushes shut the tall black door. A servant approaches her with a tray, and Solana removes the knife tucked into her skirt pocket, placing the intricate blade onto the tray. No one is allowed to enter the tower armed, not even her.
Where's Russell? She asks.
I haven't seen him, ma'am, the woman replies. Dinner will be served in 15 minutes. She glances around the vast, vacant entrance hall with its tall, windowless black walls and arched ceiling. Don't be late. He's in a mood tonight. The maid is talking about her father, the great Lord Mordeth. Solana shakes her head, thanks the woman, climbs the winding tower stairs up to Russell's rooms. If father is angry, it's best they arrive to dinner together. Strength in numbers and all that. With a quick rap on the door, she pushes it open and glances into his round room. He isn't on his bed or on the windowsill reading. He isn't at his desk. Solana sighs, goes down to the library, but Russell isn't in his usual armchair. She moves through the tall, rounded bookcases, which expand in consecutive circles from the center, and with every new stack, her stomach tightens a little. She checks the tower rooftop. The hot wind ruffles her dark hair, then sweeps round, pressing her skirts into her thighs. Solana looks out onto the ocean to the west of Chosa, at the thick, murky green waves, lapping softly at the cliff, so slow and lethargic in the heat that they seem more dead than alive. Beyond the tower property, the cliff is lined with rows of pulleys that the citizens use to cast down nets, bringing up heavy loads of sparkling gray fish, or sometimes bigger things clawed and twisted, with thick hides and terrible teeth, more monsters than living creatures. Those are sold as oddities, or brought into the tower as rare gifts. To the east, the city stretches out, all the windows twinkling in the dusk. The Chosa Gate, enormous and red, delineates the city from the farmlands. Around the very edges of the wall, hidden by the soft white surface of the demons, the land is green, a little further out, and everything becomes an overgrown brown. All that soil hasn't been cultivated in 2 decades, the people afraid to work land further than an hour on foot from the rusting iron gates. What an utter tragedy. No one can fix this. It's an entire country. If the Maker himself can't help them, why would the old crone say the White Lady can? She's not even real, thinks Solana as she goes back down the stairs, peers into the training room, the baths, the kitchens, her father's bedroom, her own. She frowns. Where else can Russell be? But of course, it's dinner time. The boy must be already at table, waiting for them to start eating. Always hungry. Growing boys. When she doesn't find him in the dining room, her hands begin to shake. She goes up to her father's study. He's bent double over whatever documents he's working on. I'm still working, he says. Start dinner without me if you're so impatient. Papa? He looks up. She hasn't called him Papa in years. Solana licks her lips, opens her mouth, tries to speak, but nothing comes out. Well, what is it, girl? Papa, I can't find Russell anywhere.